Welcome to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Sir Tomoti Karitu has made it his mission to revitalize indigenous languages around the world. He and a dozen other representatives recently visited the United States on a five-city tour, and special contributor Alicia Hagelin Thorpe covered his stop in Bismarck.
That is a traditional haka greeting by a small group of the Maori Language Commission of New Zealand as they make their way across the powwow circle at the Lone Star Arena at United Tribes Technical College. There, they are met by several tribal nations of the Ocheti Shakowi, the MHA Nation, the Turtle Mountain Band of Chippewa Indians, and Sioux Valley, Manitoba. It was a long-awaited visit for this particular Maori delegation, a trip that was 4 years in the making. It was planned originally for 2020, but with the pandemic spreading across the world, this trip across the globe required a change of plans. It was a scorching 100 degrees the day the delegation arrived from New Zealand, bringing Sir Tomoti Karitu, known throughout the world as an expert and a leader in language revitalization. This gathering of nations was for him.
Before I get underway with our traditional greeting, I'd just like to explain that the haka that you witnessed earlier is a symbol of our adoration for you. We come in love, we come in appreciation to honour you for the years of love and adoration you've shown our esteemed leader, Sir Tomoti Karitu. At this juncture, that I'll take the opportunity to respond to such adoration in our traditional way through whai kōrero. So bear with me. Some of you and some of these ones may find it a little long. Too bad. The longer the kōrero, the bigger the mihi, and the bigger the show of gratitude and love. Nō reira, ka nui te mihi me te aroha ki a koutou. Ti hei mauri ora, e kōrero ti ana te wera o te rā. E kōrero ti ana te rere a te manu. E kōrero ti ana te rere a ngā kapo kapo oi. Katoa e nā he tohu pai. Nō reira, kia whakamoi mi titi ai ai te wāhi ngaro.
I'm going to share a loose translation of what I shared in our traditional mother tongue. I started the presentation off by acknowledging the signs. The eagle that flew, the dragonflies we witnessed, the sun that's beaming down on us are for us as Māori good signs. They're a sign of a good hui and a good gathering for which we are grateful. I also acknowledged the 10 years or so that have passed and the events that have happened in that time. We also record the event which took place where you kindly gifted the name Bahanas Kaska upon our leader in acknowledgement of his work with Indigenous language revitalization. Because of that honour, we have come to show our love and appreciation to you all, as I said earlier.
Tribal elders and dignitaries from the region welcomed the delegation and Sir Tomoti. Some greeted them with their own language, and others, like North Dakota Representative Jamie Davis from the Turtle Mountain Band of Chippewa and Standing Rock Tribes, who explains the impact that language has had on her family.
When my relative Tipi first asked me to do the welcome for the Maori delegation, I of course said yes. With no hesitation, because I knew the importance of this cultural exchange, and I'm happy and most honored to be included. Afterwards, though, his name and the school and just the story kind of hit me. Rang a few bells, but I couldn't place exactly why. So I thought back and did some digging, and here I came across some papers that I did my freshman year of college back in 2000. I wrote a persuasive argument for the need of Indigenous immersion schools here in North Dakota. My whole argument was based on the success of the Maori immersion school and the Hawaiian immersion school. My findings hit home because I imagined like what my life would be like if I was raised with either of my Indigenous languages, which is Ojibwe and Lakota, or both. Because I know it can be done. My great-grandmother spoke five languages fluently, which was Ojibwe, Cree, Michif, French, and English. And in the final paragraph of one of my papers I had written, I hope the leadership of these schools will one day teach our tribes here in North Dakota how to create immersion schools. And here we are today. Fighting this paper brought me back to being 18 years old and all the opportunities and possibilities that lay ahead. One constant being the learning of our language. Again, I'm still learning. 10 years or so later, my mother, who is a citizen of Standing Rock, she and I attended the Lakota Immersion Language Program at Sitting Bull College. Due to, in her time when she was growing up, United States policy, she was not allowed to speak her language, but her parents spoke it in secret. So when we attended, she wasn't sure if she would remember anything. But as we started, I saw her eyes light up, and she would recall some of what the instructors were saying. And I remember her grabbing my leg, and she looked at me with a big smile, and she said, "Jamie, I know what they're saying." Then her, along with the instructor, started telling stories of them learning Lakota and getting a few words wrong here and there and laughing about it. I absolutely love how her eyes lit up from recalling those memories and hearing her speak her language. I will cherish those memories for a lifetime. And jump to a few months ago, I had a similar moment with my father, who is a citizen of the Turtle Mountain Band of Ojibwe and served as our tribal college president for 13 years. During his time as college president, culture and language were his priorities. He said, "You cannot have culture without the language." So that is my main focus for him and his administration at the time. Now, we are on tribal college land here, and I'm sure many of you know that tribal colleges don't get a whole lot of funding, especially when it comes to the priorities of our culture and our language. He socked away funding a little at a time so the college could create and implement its very own Ojibwe language program. There were some hard times when they could have dipped into that little nest to make hard times not so hard. But Dad held firm. Dad retired back in 2018, but his administration kept firm on that program, and it all paid off in 2022 when the first Ojibwe language cohort graduated from the Turtle Mountain Community College. They are now teachers in our communities and passing the language on. Dad hasn't stopped there. Like my mom and I, Dad wants to keep learning. So a couple months ago, we took a part in an Ojibwe language table. He too said, "Gee, I wonder if I'll know any words that they bring up." Sure enough, he knew almost all of the words and was even teaching me how to pronounce them correctly. I've been to grocery stores and movie theaters where everything is in Ojibwe. I walk into these places is like walking into dreams of dreamers. What makes it even more magical to me is that it's real. Like today, today is magical for me. Today is full circle moment for me. From writing that paper that opened my eyes and mind to a world that once was and will be again, to now welcoming you to our homelands is one of my greatest honors. Sir Timothy Karatu, you have helped to create a path that many will follow for generations to come. Miigwech.
DJ Driver of the MHA Nation teaches Native American Studies at the Nueta Hidaze Saanich Tribal College in Newtown, North Dakota. Here, he shares his appreciation for Sir Timothy's impact on language revitalization.
All across Indian country, not too long ago, just a few short years ago, we weren't allowed to speak our language. If we went to boarding school, we got in trouble. So when we got home and tried to speak our language at home, then the moms and dads and grandmas and grandpas said, "You know, we don't want you to do that because we got in trouble for that. They hurt us for speaking our language." So there's that divide from speakers and non-fluent speakers. That's in more recent times, that's where it started from, the boarding school era. So it was chosen not to teach because of what our speakers faced and the repercussions. But here today, we start to have these immersion schools coming up. And back home, we have one for the Hidaze that's a fully functioning one, but we only have just a few students, and they're children. They're little children, and I'm blessed and honored to have two of my children have gone through that program. And this immersion program, and while they're doing the research and things, you know, it was a lot of reference that went back to the Maori people, and our esteemed guest, you know, his name would come up, you know, through all those planning and different things. And as a tribe went to different conferences and their different delegations were formed all throughout the country, we took the groundwork that was laid over in your homeland, and we brought that back, and that information was shared with our people. And they said, "You know, we could do this, because there's a tribe over there that have done it already, and they have speakers now, so we can move forward." We can't do it without a prayer. Everything that we do starts with a prayer. And I'm real honored to be a part of this prayer greeting ceremony that I witnessed today. You know, it's something I'm not going to forget, you know, for the rest of my life. And, you know, once again, I want to thank you guys for being here. On behalf of the three tribes, on behalf of the Hidatsa people, we're trying our best. My dad was a speaker. He was an educator for many years. And so I tried to remember things that he taught me, is not only about our culture, but as well as trying to keep the language alive. And we have a few speakers left at home, but we have something to go by now. You've made your presence known in Indian country and also throughout the world. So the world, as far as in the name of language revitalization, the world owes you a thank you.
Like I said, my mom was a Dakota language speaker, and she actually taught at the college. She was, I think, one of the first, if not the first, language instructors at our tribal college. And I actually attended a couple of her classes, but then again, you know, I wasn't ready for it. There were more Wushichi people there learning the language than there were Indians. And I look back at those days and I regret my disinterest in those languages. It amazes me to see a group of people such as our visitors here speaking their language. It fills my heart with pride that Indigenous people can express themselves proudly in their own language. I know there are successful immersion programs around Indian country, and I only hope that they get the support and help from the tribal communities, from the tribal leaders, and funding sources to continue language. What will we do without our language? With that, Nina Kata Do. It's really hot. Probably only three words I remember. That is a long drive home. So I'm going to close with that. And I welcome our guest. I wish you a safe and happy journey home. I'm pleased to meet you. Proud to see all these hardworking, beautiful Indian students here. Keep up the good work. Doksha.
That was Dr. Eric Longy, a retired tribal historian from the Spirit Lake Nation. This historical visit was part of Sir Timoti's farewell tour. Over a decade ago, he visited Standing Rock and became close to the elders and traditional speakers of the tribe. He formed a special mentorship with Standing Rock citizen T.P. Ziwi Tolman, a passionate Lakota language educator and organizer of this event. Taking her under his wing, she and others explored the idea of creating a Lakota language immersion school in Fort Yates. Sir Timoti is most revered by many elders and fluent speakers in the area because of that visit. He spoke of the importance of revitalizing language in a broader context, and it made a lot of people think. Tolman says his words may have been a bit more than what the elders were expecting, but they were spoken with love, and they resonated with many.
We were privy to a conversation that he had one-on-one with our elder fluent speaker teachers who were gathered, and he didn't mince words. Those of us who were in that room, he shaped us up and sent us on our way to do the work. And the majority in that room were fluent speakers who went through those hardships and went through those hard times, but they still were speakers and they wanted to teach their language in the mainstream schools on our reservation. And he asked them some serious questions. He asked them, who in here is a fluent speaker? And they raised their hand. And he said, so who of you have a fluent speaking first language child or grandchild? And none of them raised their hand. And he had some very strong words for them that I don't dare repeat. But only an elder, an Indigenous elder, could speak to them in that way. And those of us who witnessed that conversation were changed forever. It was very much like an angry grandfather who's holding you accountable out of love, holding you to a standard of excellence that you're capable of. And I have never seen anything like that in my life, and I don't know that I ever will see anything like that again.
Sir Timoti Keritu became the catalyst behind several language schools in Indian country, including the Lakota Immersion Nest in Fort Yates, which Tolman helped to found in 2012. Keritu is also co-founder and board member of the first Maori Language Commission in New Zealand that started in 1972, and he served as the first head of the Department of Maori at the University of Waikato. eventually becoming a professor of the language. He also oversaw the implementation of the Maori Language Act of 1987. Sir Timothy was adopted by ceremony into Te Piziwi's family and given the name Paha Hanskaska. She shares how Lala Timothy received this much revered name, meaning long hills.
I asked my elders who were there, how do I do this? This is what I want to do. And they told me how and told me what I should do and how I should do it. Find the oldest name in your family tree, and that will be the one that has the highest honor to give him. And so we descend from a man who lived in the late 1700s. His name was Paha Hanskaska. He died as a young man defending our Dakota homeland. So we had a ceremony for Lala Timothy to gift him, through our ceremonies and through our songs, the name Paha Hanskaska, which is long hills or long buttes. And that name comes from our Ocheti Shakoi lands. And it is a very old name that's connected to these lands for a long time.
This event was originally planned in Fort Yates on the Standing Rock Reservation. But Tolman says that United Tribes Technical College Powwow Arena served as a great middle ground for everyone to meet. She says Kiritu's short visit would be best served in a neutral space that is home to many tribal members, while also respecting the traditional homelands of the MHA Nation. Getting the Maori delegation here to North Dakota was a grassroots effort. It took many volunteers from all over the area to come together to support one another and this special visit. Tolman says hosting this at United Tribes provided a great opportunity for students and families to witness history and be inspired to do great things for their communities.
Wopela means thank you. That's the Lakota Immersion School students from the Rosebud Indian Reservation saying Wopela to Sir Timothy Karitu for his work to revitalize indigenous languages. Bismarck was one of his five stops in the United States. Coming up next, an update on Friday afternoon programming with Prairie Public's Director of Radio, Bill Thomas. Stay with us.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, investing in great ideas and the people who power them in Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota, and the 23 Native nations that share that same geography. Learn more at bushfoundation.org.
On the next Radiolab,
we love our names. I mean,
everybody's got one.
What is your name?
Introduce yourself for me. Tell me your name.
They carry expectations.
I could be the last of a Webster.
History.
A way of being attached to the dead.
Secret messages.
Yaka, Hika, Mika, Dola.
Oh my gosh.
We bring you stories about names and how they shape and define our lives. That's on the next Radiolab.
Saturday at noon, 11 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
Welcome back to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, visiting with Director of Radio here at Prairie Public, Bill Thomas. Bill, welcome back to Main Street.
Sure, glad to be here.
We're here on a Friday, Bill, and it's the last Friday that we'll have Main Street. We have some changes that will be coming to our air, and we wanted you to talk about it.
Yeah, we're bringing in a new show at 3 p.m. on Fridays. We're going to be running a show called The Middle. It's just starting up. They've done a few short-run things during elections and so on to kind of test out the concept, but they're starting it end of September as their beginning date. And this is a call-in show, and it's being—
National call-in show.
National call-in show. It's being produced out of Champaign-Urbana, Illinois, which is a community with a lot in common with, say, Grand Forks or Fargo-Moorhead. It's a university town, or like Bismarck-Mandan in Fargo-Moorhead. It's a dual town. And they are focusing on the middle. And by that, they mean both geographically and on different issues. They said, you know, there's a lot of conflict between different extremes, New York, L.A., political extremes.
The far left, the far right.
Yeah. And they say, but a lot of us feel like, but I'm somewhere in the middle. And that's kind of where they want to come down. So it's not going to be exclusively a geographic focus, but they'll definitely want to highlight the Midwest. A couple of the key people in the program, Jeremy Hobson, is working. He's back in Champaign-Urbana now after a career in other public radio places, including hosting Here and Now, which was a major public radio program, and working at NPR and at different stations. So he's back doing this and really hoping to highlight voices from the middle and have that kind of a conversation. So we're excited to be starting that. We think it's something that when we've run their short-term things, people have reacted positively to the show, and so we're going to try it out.
I'm really looking forward to that, Bill, but now I'm really looking forward to what's going to happen at 7 o'clock. Listeners will know that Prairie Public's Main Street airs at 3 p.m. and 7 p.m. We re-air the show, but we have something new and different to our listeners, but it's been around public radio for a long time. It's my favorite show of all time, Bill, I will
okay.
admit.
I didn't put it on because of that, but yeah. It's a show called Science Friday, and a lot of people who move here from other places, who've listened to other public radio stations or who have traveled and listened to other stations have heard it and have often asked about it, and here's a chance to put it on. So instead of repeating the middle at 7, as we do with Main Street, we're going to run Science Friday at that time with Ira Flatow, and it is a program, just like its name says, focuses on science. Runs on a Friday.
Yeah, and current-day science topics. They review the current news in science that oftentimes we wouldn't maybe necessarily see until a week or two or a month or two later.
Right, right. They really keep up with things. And I've talked with the people who produce the shows and with Ira Flatow. And, I mean, they're just in a constant stream of looking at news and information and new ideas and new studies that are coming out and new insights in science. So
what I like most about that show is he tries to cultivate the most current and smartest, in my opinion, reporters who really watch the world of science, how it will impact our lives today and in the future. He really reaches out to those people to make really sound conversation, I feel.
Yeah, and I'm somebody who's interested in what people are doing in different fields of science, and I think a lot of our listeners are. One of the tricks with reporting on things like this is how to make it relatable and comprehensible without oversimplifying. And that's a real skill, and they have a knack for it at Science
Friday. They really do. It's been around for a long time. Plus, he's an incredible table tennis player. I like that, too. Bill, we are going to air The Middle on Fridays at 3, Science Friday on Prairie Public at 7 on Friday. But Monday through Thursday, we're still going to have Main Street.
Yeah, and the Main Street staff will have more time. You and the other people who work on the show will be able, I hope, to, you know, really put more time into the 4 days that we have instead of 5 and do even better work for our listeners.
And I think we'll even maybe be able to travel a little bit more without the pressure of having to produce that fifth show on a Friday.
Yeah, yeah. It's a concern to us as a statewide network to get out and be around the state, and we hope this will allow for more of that.
Got about a minute left, Bill. You've been traveling and just returned back to Prairie Public yesterday. Where have you been?
I was at the Public Radio Content Conference in Philadelphia. It's put on to discuss all things content in public radio. So there was certainly a lot of talk about a lot of different national shows and how they hope stations would pick them up, but also a lot of discussion about the shift to more emphasis on digital distribution of programs, discussions about changing values. I was really interested. Eric Newsom was there, and he's just written an article that's gone around nationally about millennial listeners to public radio and their reaction to the core values that were defined for public radio 25 years ago. So very, very interesting discussions that I think will help us do a better job.
You saw a lot of the big names with public radio. It must have been fun for you, Bill.
Yeah, yeah. It was nice to see them and be able to talk to them again. Some of them I've known for years. So,
Bill Thomas, Prairie Public's Director of Radio, thank you for joining us on Main Street.
Sure thing.
Coming up next, our news chat with Dave Thompson, Prairie Public's News Director. But first, today's news.
From the Prairie Public Newsroom, I'm Todd McDonald. Farmers can save money by using practices that improve soil. That's according to a study of 30 farms across the U.S. by the Soil Health Institute. On average, these farmers saw a net farm income increased by $65 an acre per year. But Kelly Wilson, Associate Director of the Center for Regenerative Agriculture at University of Missouri, says it's important to keep in mind different regions have different climates and soil types.
That can be really hard to just like look at something like this and compare it across. But still, it's really valuable to have these qualitative asking for direct reporting.
The Soil Health Institute hopes the study can help farmers make informed decisions about switching to soil healthy practices, including cover crops and no-till farming. Aaron Dupree has been chosen to lead the Minnesota Office of Cannabis Management. Dupree founded a low-dose THC company that she will leave behind to oversee Minnesota's move to a legal market for full-fledged cannabis products. The office is charged with regulating all cannabis use in the state. DFL Representative Zach Stevenson of Coon Rapids was chief House author of the measure to legalize recreational marijuana. He says Dupree has a big job ahead of her.
All of the policy goals of cannabis legalization are at stake here. You want someone who's really focused on making sure that we're doing a good job to transition from that black market to a legitimate market.
Stevenson says he thinks it'll be more than a year before there are widespread retail outlets for marijuana products in Minnesota. And while North Dakota doesn't have voter registration, civic engagement groups say efforts are still needed to help underserved populations get prepared to vote. Mike Moen of the Prairie News Service reports on an event this week focused on helping Native American communities.
Tuesday was National Voter Registration Day, and North Dakota Native Vote began its own outreach initiative. Voter ID Day involved working with enrollment offices on reservations around the state where members could come in and update their tribal ID. The group's Nicole Donaghy says it helps them comply with the state's strict requirements for casting a ballot. She says this awareness issue still comes up in elections.
Being on standby, we would have to explain the consent decree and how our relatives without proper ID should be able to cast their ballot and then come back and have it verified.
The controversial law led to a consent decree in 2020 after some tribes brought legal challenges, arguing it placed extreme burdens on indigenous communities. Donaghy says this week's event saw 150 people update their IDs ahead of the 2024 election. I'm Mike Moen.
And from the Prairie Public Newsroom, I'm Todd McDonald.
When she would prepare a large amount of food, for example, if we would be there for a meal on a weekend or something, she might say, "I hope you're hungry because I have enough for Cox's Army."
Join us this week on Away with Words.
What school did you go to? I went to the wrong school.
That's Away with Words, Saturday at 9 Central, 8 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
It's time for our weekly visit about the news with Prairie Public's Dave Thompson. Dave, welcome back to Main Street.
Oh, thank you, Craig. Good to be back.
We have maybe a soggy weekend to
look forward to here. Now, the latest things I've been looking for, the National Weather Service this morning, they said some parts of our region, especially south central to east central North Dakota, could get as high as 3 inches of rain.
Wow, that's a lot.
Some parts of the state will get 1 to 2. Some parts of the state might get a half an inch. But it looks like a lot of the state is going to get some rain.
Needed rain, especially in the northeastern part of the state.
That's correct, where there has been kind of a drought situation. It's now, I think it's exceptional drought, correct?
I believe that's true, yes. Yeah. So this will be helpful. Dave, let's zoom into the news here.
Okay.
Local governments had a deadline to submit requests for funding for snow removal, but two subdivisions were a little bit late. What's the latest there?
Okay, what happened, and I'll go back with the history of this. We had such a rough winter, and there were a lot of snowstorms. As a matter of fact, I think this is a record of how many nights I had to spend at the radio station. I think I spent 5 nights here on a couple of
different
storms.
I remember those emails that you sent to the staff, Dave. Kudos to you for being willing to do that. I hope our listeners appreciate it, but continue on.
But yes, it affected a lot of states, and some of these smaller cities and counties ran out of money. So they made some money available on a first-come, first-served basis. Basically, you had to apply for it. And most of the cities who have applied did get some money to help with the clearing of snow, but there were two subdivisions, one county and one city, Wells County and the city of Center, who were said you didn't get them in time, and they're both refuting that. They say we did get them in on time. It's just there was a mix-up somewhere. So there are legislators who are saying, well, let's see if we can make them whole. So there's going to be a discussion at the next Emergency Commission meeting about getting some money out to these two political subdivisions.
Maybe all's well that will finally end well there.
Probably.
Dave, the legislature's budget section has approved two road projects. One, the reconstruction of North Dakota 49 from Hart Butte to Glen Olin. And the other, a second project, is reconstruction of North Dakota 14 from I-94 to Wing.
Right. In the Highway 49 thing, of course, Lake Chida, that's a very well-used road. And now they want to take the weight limits off it. It's a 7-ton weight limit. And allow more traffic on that road because they need it. And allow more tourist traffic to go back and forth between I-94 and Hart Butte, which is Lake Chida. But in the case of Highway 14, which is a state highway, it's a fairly narrow road, and they want to widen it and make that also amenable to large trucks, because some large trucks would like to make it a bypass and avoid the Bismarck-Mandan area, especially if they're going north. You go north on 83, yeah, it is a good road, but you have to go through signal lights and through parts of downtown Bismarck, so you don't want to do that. So the Highway Department is saying, okay, we understand. We'll get some of these bigger trucks who are heading north toward Minot in that area to get them off that congested part of Bismarck streets.
Sounds like a needed improvement for sure.
Very much so.
The state of North Dakota, Dave, continues to have, and I'm using air quotes here, money in the bank. Things are looking relatively rosy right now.
Right. Right now it's $1.5 billion. In the bank right now. And that is stuff that is carried over from the last legislative session. And they're going to start, when they start budgeting in 2 years, they will have at least $1.5 billion as an ending fund balance to start the budgeting process. Now, that looks pretty good. It's a lot better than what the legislature had projected, which was $1.1 billion, but there's been some turn back and there's been some added revenues, especially from sales tax. And they have not calculated all the income tax yet because there's been some timing situations. They think it might even go higher than $1.5 billion.
And that general fund turn back was well over $100 million.
Yes. Now, these are funds that agencies did not spend in the previous biennium. So they turn it back to the state government general at large to be used as part of the ending fund balance.
Dave, I've never smoked a cigar, but apparently I may be able to do so inside in Mandan.
That's correct. And this is interesting because the legislature passed a bill to allow cigar bars, and Mandan took a look at the issue. They had a request from a local cigar dealer to add a cigar bar, and as the mayor of Mandan says, they had three options. One is to ban it outright. And he was uncomfortable because tobacco is still a legal product. One is to just let the state law go into effect and not have any controls on it. They took the third option, which was to have a local ordinance. They put in some requirements for ventilation, some requirements about outside air. They're looking to be a little bit more proactive, although
right.
there was quite the group that basically tried to get them to ban it entirely, but they weren't going to go that far.
I believe their thinking was they better do something, otherwise they would have no control.
That's correct,
and
yes.
Now they'll have a little say in how these will end up. Dave, the Rural Development Finance Corporation has developed a way to support the state's meat and poultry processors. What's that about?
Well, basically, we're seeing a lot more of what they call farm-to-table operations. You get from your ranch, you process the meat, you sell it locally, and perhaps they're hoping that eventually they'll be able to sell some of these regionally to other states. And there's been a lot of complaint in the agriculture industry about the concentration of the meatpacking industry, and this is a way to get out from under that.
It really surfaced during COVID for sure.
It certainly did.
Well, let's stay on the farm-to-table topic here, Dave. The president of the North Dakota Farmers Union says that the founding farmers' restaurants in Washington, D.C. are doing well. You reported about that.
I did. It's been an interesting project when Mark Watney, the president of the Farmers Union, said they were going to partner with some chefs in Washington, D.C. to open a restaurant. It turned out to be very successful. People in Washington, D.C. liked the concept, again, farm to table. So they started expanding, and now they're going to go and open their eighth restaurant, wow, which will be in Alexandria, Virginia, which could be very interesting. I haven't been to D.C. for a while. I'm kind of hoping to go on some kind of reporting trip, and I'd like to get to Founding Farmers just to experience it myself.
Sure, yeah, that would be great. I promised my wife a visit. I have been, but she hasn't, and I think it's something that we need to do. The walk from the Lincoln Memorial to the Capitol is something that I think every American
absolutely
should do.
Definitely.
All right, Dave, the holidays are coming up. The Help Wanted sign is out in Amazon, specifically for the eastern side of the state. Mm-hmm. They want to hire some folks.
They do. They're talking about hundreds of hires in the Fargo-Moorhead area. That's not only for the holiday. They say some of these, maybe a good percentage, are going to be permanent hires. They're very busy. And you can see that because Target has also announced that they're going to be hiring a lot of people for the upcoming holiday season. I'm sure you're going to see other retailers do that as well, or other shippers do that as well. But Amazon really said they are very, very busy and they need to get people. And they're hoping to get people on a career track.
Right.
You know, get in the door. And then you want to stay with Amazon and then you're going to go into supervisory eventually.
Sure. Signing bonuses are available there.
$1,000 in Fargo. Some places where it's very, very tough because they've got more competition, they're offering up to $3,000 bonuses.
Well, election laws are sure a thing across the country, Dave, and now a group in North Dakota has proposed overhauling North Dakota's election laws and have proposed a constitutional-initiated amendment to the Secretary of State's office.
Right, and what their whole point is to outlaw voting machines and outlaw
Mail-in ballots.
Mail-in ballots. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm thinking.
Here's my take on that, Dave. They just want you to have to stay up later and later and later at night as people count hand ballots. That's what I'm thinking.
Later at night, we're thinking about 3, 4, 5 days, maybe longer than that, counting hand ballots. You know, the Secretary of State office has argued, and this is where it's an interesting thing in North Dakota. Secretary of State's office has argued that, yeah, you are filling out a paper ballot. You have the ovals that you, and they only use the machines to count the ballots. But if you don't have machines to count the ballots, it's going to take a lot longer. But what's interesting is that the Secretary of State has to approve the wording for the measure, too. So, bit of a pickle there for the Secretary of State's office.
How many signatures will be required there, Dave?
31,000.
And do you think they'll get that amount of signatures?
That's a very good question because it's a long ballot with a lot of sections to the bill that they want to put in there to make sure that all the safeguards are in. And it might be just too long.
Longer, maybe more confusing for some.
Correct.
You know, I'll say, Dave, I voted just for the first time in North Dakota just a month or two ago with a local election in Horace, North Dakota.
Oh, yes.
And I loved the way I was able to vote in the state. So I hope things don't change, I guess is what I'm saying.
I think you're right. A lot of people like it the way it is.
Dave, some things might change in relative to how news is covered in your neck of the woods. Let's talk about a veteran North Dakota journalist, Blake Nicholson, who's been named the editor of the Bismarck Tribune.
Blake is one of the top people in journalism in North Dakota. I worked with Blake when he was a member of the Associated Press staff here, and we were a member of the Associated Press, and we used to feed stories to them. And during his tenure at the Tribune, we've got a relationship going. So he sometimes asks if he can use one of our stories, and I'd say sure, and then I can use Bismarck Tribune stories on the air, and that will continue. And he's done a very, very good job in keeping that newspaper relevant.
There'll be also some additions, I think, to how news might be covered at the Capitol.
Right, and that's Amy Dalrymple, the former editor of the Tribune, is going to work for that. Interesting that they're going to hire three people, including one senior reporter. And I'm hoping to get together with her on that to see if there's some way we can cooperate as well. Because, you know, being in a Capitol newsroom, a lot of us do cooperate. We don't get a lot of scoops once in a while, and you can celebrate that. But we do want to get the information out. And as I've said to the younger reporters who come into the press room at the Capitol, there is safety in numbers. The more of us that get it right, the better off all of us are going to be. Like one rising tide raises all boats.
You know, when I was covering the legislature in Wyoming, there's the Senate side, there's the House side. There's multiple committee meetings when the legislature's in session every day on both sides of the aisle. And boy, the more the merrier when it comes to paying attention to state government, especially
Absolutely.
When the legislature's in session.
Absolutely.
This is a win for the state. What are you working on, Dave? What's coming up from the newsroom here at Prairie
I have
Republic?
A little follow-up on child care initiatives in North Dakota. And I also have a story about we did not mention the property tax measure that's going to be going out there, but we have a couple of local government groups who are formally announcing their opposition to getting rid of the property tax.
That's our weekly news review with one of the most experienced journalists in North Dakota, Dave Thompson. Dave, have a great weekend.
I will, Craig. Hope you do, too.
More Main Streets ahead. Stay with us.
Gather your friends and tour the studios of some of Fargo-Moorhead's most popular artists during the FM Visual Artists Studio Crawl, October 7th and 8th, noon to 6 p.m.
Express yourself.
Prairie Public is the proud media sponsor of this fun, free family event. You can find a studio crawl map at prairiepublic.org/community or pick up a brochure and map at Plains Art Museum, O'Rourke Art Gallery, Gallery 4, at Prairie Public and many other locations in the Fargo-Moorhead area.
Express yourself.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
There's the fanfare. That means it's time for our weekly trip to the movies with our resident movie reviewer, Matt Olean. Matt, welcome back to Main Street.
Hi, Craig.
Here's how I'm going to start this one, Matt. No one should leave until I find out if the living have been killed by the dead.
Yes.
You're reviewing A Haunting in Venice.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about the movie.
So this is Kenneth Branagh's third outing now as Agatha Christie's famed detective Hercule Poirot, who's often played by British actors, it seems, Albert Finney, Peter Ustinov, now Kenneth Branagh, but he has the accent down. When the first film hit, Murder on the Orient Express, the first one Branagh did, if they had a Best Mustache Oscar category, he would get it as Poirot. And so the mustache is great again. Branagh directed this one as well, and I'll get to that in a second. But this is the third outing now. So Death on the Nile was the middle one, which is the one that was not very good. This one is better than Death on the Nile, maybe not as good as Orient Express. But overall, I like this. So it's based on Agatha Christie's story, Halloween Party. And this one, if you've seen the trailer, Craig, has a bit of horror and supernatural to it. So it's a little different than a typical Hercule Poirot mystery. In fact, I think what I liked about it was he's thrown off his game. As you can see from the trailer, Craig, there's some weird stuff going on in this.
It's an understatement, Matt, but yes.
Gigantic building, this gigantic home in Venice. It takes place 1947, right after World War II. There's a seance. Michelle Yeoh plays the medium who's brought in to do a seance to try to communicate with the dead daughter of Kelly Riley's character, Rowena Drake. So there's this seance. Poirot is brought in by his friend Tina Fey, who plays this mystery writer. Lots of characters, as usual. But he's thrown off his game. You're not sure if you're watching a horror film or a whodunit. I think that's what's interesting about this compared to past Hercule Poirot films is it feels like a horror film.
Yeah.
Can he figure out what's going on? Is it all tricks? Is it all fakery? Is he going to get to the bottom of it? Or is he really seeing dead kids, ghosts, things like that? That's what makes you kind of not sure what's going on.
Yeah, and that was going to be my first question for you, Matt, is how is that balance of mystery and horror? How is it balanced? I don't want to go see a horror movie, but I want to see a good mystery movie.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting balance that generally I think they pull off. What I didn't care about with the movie is Branagh tends to overdirect. He's got a habit when he directs films, like with Belfast a couple years ago. He kind of overdirects some scenes, which I don't know that it serves the story. You know, weird camera angles, upside down shots, this and that. He likes to do that. And I think that's all great with the right kind of movie. He overdoes it a little bit in this movie, I think. There's also a lot of characters. There's a lot of things going on. the friends I went with afterwards, we had a lot of questions like, why were they exactly there to do the seance? Why was this person there? Why were these people there? It's a little confusing
to follow.
Is the plot
hard to follow?
It's a little hard to follow. I found it hard to follow. As usual, I think Perot solves things and figures out things way too quickly, where it's like no human being could actually figure out what's going on in that quick a time. Oftentimes, these realizations by him are done in flashbacks. Well, this happened, this happened, this happened. I'm not giving anything away by that. That's what happens in all of these. Where you catch up, right?
Coming through the
that
movie.
Happens in all of these films. But I always am very curious as to how he figures this out. It's all of a sudden like, oh, he's got it. But how did he figure it out? And I think that's a little bit of weakness as well. But overall, I like the tone of the film. It's very creepy in parts.
Were the supernatural elements well done, Matt, in your eyes?
Yes, generally well done. And as I said, it keeps you guessing as to what's going on. Who's up to mischief? Who's a fake? Who's not a fake? Are there ghosts in the house in Venice? That kind of thing. So I think overall it works. I liked Michelle Yeoh as the medium. Tina Fey is kind of the helper. You know, Perot's always got a helper in these movies that kind of helps him along, kind of that assistant detective. But is she up to other things? You have to go see and check it out. So big cast, little confusing, but at least it's short. It's only an hour and 44 minutes.
We've had some water cooler discussion in the office this morning, Matt, about the film's ending. Now, we don't want you to give it away.
No.
But was it satisfying for you?
Yes and no. I'll just say yes and no. Somewhat satisfying, possibly not. There's a few tricks thrown in that I wasn't quite buying. So you'll have to go see for yourself. But it is better than Death on the Nile, which is the middle Kenneth Branagh Perot film. Doing pretty good at the box office right now, too.
How did you feel about this movie being set in Venice?
Oh, you can't go wrong being set in Venice. It's also right after the war. So you see American troops kind of hanging around in some scenes as well. They good use of the canals, of course. It takes place on Halloween. So there's, you know, kids trick-or-treating in the big building, and that gets kind of creepy and scary too. But again, you'll have to go see it to see who really is up to no good. Who's behind all this? Who's the one that's up to nefarious activities? And of course, Perot will solve everything.
Is there an age limit for this film in your eyes, Matt? What's it rated? Is it maybe inappropriate for middle school and younger?
I'd say middle school might be okay. Younger, I would say no, because there are some creepy elements going on here and some fairly graphic death scenes as well.
Will this Agatha Christie theme continue on in the movies?
I think as long as the Branagh playing Perot works and gets decent box office, they'll keep doing them. I think he recognizes he's probably got a franchise here. He's perfected the role pretty well, I think. And they're not necessarily sequels to each other, to the previous film. You can have different characters come in next time, different people with different motives.
All right, Matt, it's time for trivia. Let's keep an Agatha Christie theme here. Which Agatha Christie movies have won Academy Awards for Best Adapted Screenplay?
I would say Witness for the Prosecution, 1957.
Correct.
Outside of that, I'm not sure.
Murder on the Orient Express,
okay,
in 74.
And Ingrid Bergman got supporting actress also for the 74 version of Orient Express.
We've been to the movies with Matt Olien.
I'm just going to come out and say it. Concert etiquette these days is out of hand. This week, I'm getting into why we keep seeing all these stories about fans throwing anything from a cell phone to a chunk of brie at their favorite artist. The sad state of concert etiquette and what can be done about it. Next time on It's Been a Minute from NPR.
Saturday at 2 Central, 1 Mountain.
Today's Dakota Datebook is part of an ongoing weekly series produced in partnership with the Department of Public Instruction on Indigenous Peoples themes.
North Dakota Native American Essential Understanding Number 5 is about tribal policies, treaties, and sovereignty. It states, Native people practice self-determination, developing tribal policies and practicing political activism. Despite a history of U.S. policies and treaties that have often been detrimental,
Native people are members of sovereign nations that predate the U.S. government. In this episode of Dakota Datebook, we'll listen to J.T. Shining Oneside, enrolled member of the Turtle Mountain Band of the Chippewa Nation, discuss treaties and the Department of the Interior.
We have treaties today because of the lands that we once had, and I know for the Anishinaabe, we moved from up around Maine area all the way down towards the eastern seaboard. We moved, and they said when we left there, we numbered in the stars as we were moving, and then we came to these different stopping areas that we stopped at, and different bands and groups of Anishinaabe would go to these different places. And then eventually, as the United States government started formulating itself, they created the Department of Interior. That was created as like a war department. And who was the war department against? They were against the American Indian people that were here. They would sit and they would smoke the pipe with the Native people. They would sign documents, you know, talk about things, you know, do the treaties and everything. And on their way back to Washington with their documents, well, then this is when the encroachment started to happen. Things would start happening on both sides. It's important to remember the treaties, though, because those are part of the things that make us, you know, who we are today and help us to know what our rights are as First Nations people, as American Indian people, so that we can continue to have a place, you know, for our people.
I'm Sharla Stever. If you'd like to learn more about the North Dakota Native American Essential Understandings and to listen to more Indigenous Elder interviews, visit www.teachingsofourelders.org. Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota. Funding for this series is from Humanities ND and the North Dakota Department of Public Instruction.
Leadership coach Ann Morris has a playbook with daily steps for fixing work problems fast.
Yeah, so it's Monday through Friday. Each day has a distinct agenda that builds on itself, and the headline is that you build trust and then you earn the right to sprint.
Upending the work week. That's next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Sunday at noon, 11 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
And that's a wrap for today's Main Street. Thank you so much for joining us. Remember, you can hear this and all past episodes of Main Street at our website at prairiepublic.org or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. Monday on Main Street, we'll hear from UND philosophy professor Jack Russell Weinstein. He joins us for this month's Philosophical Currents discussion of current social issues. We hope you'll join us again Monday on Main Street.